This is Phil Farron.
I can't get my keys.
And I am driving home. I didn't have my keys in my hands like I normally do. And I couldn't get them in the ignition. I am driving. It's amazing how long that feels when you can't get something working. And then I listen back to it later. I'm like, well, that's like half a second. What am I worried about? But it just feels so long. It's not in the key. It's not in the key. It's not in the ignition. Anyways. It's been a good week. Got a lot of stuff done. Had some unexpected things come up. But hey, you know, when does that not happen? Had some nice conversations this week with friends. I had three this week. Got together with the buddy on Monday morning, and then got together with another buddy on Tuesday evening, and got together with another buddy this morning. It is episode 361, I believe. Oh, I gotta talk to my kids and my wife tomorrow. I gotta talk to them about doing a podcast in a couple of weeks for the 7 years worth of podcasts. Gotta talk to them about that. Anyways, been a good week. Got a lot of things done. Didn't quite get as much done on the book as I wanted to. A Seed in Secret. Although I'm not sure if that's what it's going to be called. Some of the parables, some of the versions call it The Seed Growing Secretly. But then some of them just call it The Parable of the Growing Seed. And so I got to look. I got to see what I'm going to actually name this book. Got to work through that. Got to work through it. But anyways, I'm up somewhere around page... I don't know, is it 380, somewhere in there, I think I am. I'm at, I think 122,000 words. No, 102,000 words, 112,000, maybe it's in there somewhere. And I still got a little ways to go, but I'm closing in on it, and I'm hoping to have a really good weekend. You know, hope to get 4,000 or 5,000 words down this weekend, get me closer, and then I'm actually going to take a writing vacation next week. This is the split week between February and March, and because of the way the days fall, there are actually 4 weeks of Monday through Thursdays in February that I've already done, and then there'll be another 4 weeks of Mondays through Thursdays in March after next week. And so, done and done. You know, I'll be able to make my obligations and be able to make budget and still have several days to write. So I'm going to go ahead and take a writing vacation and try to plow through this and get caught up, because I'm about 2 weeks off, but I think I can get those 2 weeks made up next week, because normally a week is, you know, 20 hours or so. If I can keep my fingers going for that long, sometimes, and brain, sometimes I just have to stand up and clear my brain and then get back to it and hit it again and replenish the glucose in my system, because I find when I'm writing, I burn glucose out of my brain pretty quickly. But anyways, I am in the home stretch now. I'm getting things resolved and in the home stretch. So I'm hoping I can get things roughed in by the end of next week. I can start my read. That read will take me a couple of weeks to get through. And then start the cover. And... you know, hopefully have it to beta somewhere around early April. That's the plan. And then I start on the next one. It never quits. It's okay, though. I was telling... Oh, maybe it was 4 this week. That's right. I talked to another buddy on Monday evening. It was 4 this week. This was a good week. I was talking to a buddy Monday evening and describing to him that one of the reasons I think it's good for me to do this, especially this big, huge series, is because right now in my work experience, I have enough experience, in my work experience, that things are pretty stable. I have enough skills. I have enough projects under my belt. I have enough longevity in the industry. Things are pretty stable. You know, even if my current client, if something would happen to them, I'm pretty sure I could just kind of hang out my shingle and go around and knock on a few doors and find myself a job. So I think that would be fine. Get myself a headhunter. Thankfully, it doesn't look like I'm going to not be working for my current client for any time soon. And things are puttering along there. I think it's going well. We're getting accomplished what we need to get accomplished. So all that's good. And that's puttering along pretty well. So anyways, what that means is, as I was telling my buddy, that things are stable. And I'm getting a funny noise off the car. Maybe it's time to... Or maybe it's coming from the car in front of me. I don't know. Anyways, what that means, though, is there isn't a lot of surprises in what I'm doing. And even if there is kind of a reorientation or something that needs to be done, it's just like, well, hey, that's fine, moving forward. So because of that, there's not a lot of reliance on the unknown working out. And there's something to be said for having unknowns in our lives and learning to live within the tension of the unknown. Learning to ease out of the anxiety that the unknown sometimes causes us in our lives. And, and I told him that's why I like writing at this stage in my life, and especially being pushed to accomplish something, 2 books a year, push, because it keeps that pressure on to move forward, just keep moving forward, and in the process of moving forward, you take enough steps and you kind of part the mist and then you look back behind you and you can see, hey, look, that's working out. That's putting together. That's going to be okay. Whereas when you're first getting started, you're thinking, another 400 pages? What in the world am I going to put another 400 pages up? But as you just move forward, it just opens up. You find things to talk about. So, you know, that aspect of it, that requirement of just moving blindly forward, I think there's a good lesson to learn in that. That you just try to be diligent, you try to do a good job, and then you try to listen, and you just see what happens. So that's good. It's good. And this series, if all goes as planned, this series will take me right up to just after I retire. And so it'll take me through this time in my life when maybe things aren't as exciting as they possibly could be in terms of work. It's just going in, trying to be diligent, doing a good job. And there's something to be said for that as well. Applying yourself to a task and doing it with diligence, whether or not it's the most exciting thing in the world. There's plenty to be said for that, because that causes a certain discipline in our lives, and discipline is good. It's good to be able to be disciplined and to do the things that need to be done for really no other, you know, exciting reason than they just need to be done. So anyway, it's been a good week. Enjoyed writing, got some good things written this week already, but I'm really going to try to plow in this weekend and get more done. And then, come next week, we're going to see how much I can get done. And obviously, if my client has a problem next week, I will run in for that problem. I think for the podcast next week, if all goes as planned, I'm just going to have to go, like, drive around. Because I won't actually be, unless there's a problem, at my client's next week. But we'll see how that goes. So all is well. All is well. It's good. Everything's good. I came across an interesting article, and I've told a couple of my friends about it at this point. And I thought, oh, I'll do that on the podcast, because this is pretty interesting. At least it's interesting to me, which is the whole point. Because if I was interested in actually doing these podcasts to get the most number of listeners that I could, I would be doing them on other topics with some production value, as opposed to just flapping my gums as I drive home. Came across this article, and the title of the article was "Fear of a Vengeful God May Explain Humanity's Global Expansion." This is by Niraj Chokshi. 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 It's from a week or so ago. There was a study. It was done, this was actually a peer-reviewed paper that was published by the journal Nature that finds that people who hold beliefs in a punitive God tend to act less selfishly. Now, this is a fairly, you know, don't jump to a lot of conclusions on this, because it's a fairly narrow observation. But I think it's an interesting observation. And like I said, I've been chatting with my buddies about it this week, and they seem to find it interesting as well. So, there you go. So the article starts out by saying that the fear that a punitive God is watching may have helped humanity's global expansion, a team of international researchers argues in a new paper. So they say when people are inclined to behave impartially towards each other, even if it's because they fear retribution, they are more likely to adopt behaviors that can create and support large-scale cooperative institutions such as trades and market. In other words, what they're saying is that fear of a punitive God may not be the best thing for us personally, but it may evoke certain behaviors in us which causes the ability, there to be the ability to form societal structures. So that's interesting. The lead author of the paper, Benjamin Perzyski, a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of British Columbia's Center for Human Evolution, Cognition, and Culture, says, they're, referring to people who have this belief, they're playing by the rules towards people they never interact with. So they are following their rules, even though they never interact with these people. And so that magnanimous behavior, Krushuski and his colleagues argue, may be what helped foster the trust needed for humanity's growth. So what they did, in order to investigate this, what they did is they set up experiments in 8 communities of varying sizes in Brazil, Fiji, Mauritius, whatever, Siberia, Tanzania, and Vanuatu. Oh, so bad. Nearly 600 people participated, representing a wide range of faith, from Christianity to Hinduism to Buddhism, animism, and ancestor worship. So they went and they got themselves a fairly wide swath of humanity, and they asked them to play a pair of economic games. In each game, participants received 30 coins, 2 cups, and a dice with half of its 6 sides, 1 color, and the other half of its six sides another color. In other words, these dice were set up so you could roll them, and you'd get, there was a 50% chance you'd get one color, 50% chance you'd get another color. They were told to mentally pick a cup and roll the dice. They were then instructed, based on the dice color, to put the coin in either into the cup they were imagining or the ones they weren't. But they were just imagining them in their heads. In both experiments, one cup was assigned to a distant and anonymous adherent of the participant's religion. The second cup was either assigned to a participant, to the participant, or to an anonymous adherent of the same religion. So, in the first one, the cup is assigned to a participant, someone of the participant's religion. In the second test, the second cup was either assigned to the participant themselves or to an anonymous local adherent of the same religion. Now, participants were told that each cup's contents at the end of the game would go to whomever it was assigned. After the games, they were also asked a series of questions related to their religious beliefs. Okay, in theory, the game would end up with an average of 15 coins split evenly in either cup thanks to random chance. But the experimenters designed the game to make it easy to cheat because participants chose the cup in their head. They could easily override the rules, and they did. They said, as might be expected, participants were most likely to cheat in their own favor. They were least likely to cheat in the favor of their distant co-religionists. However, the higher a participant rated their god as moralistic, knowledgeable, and punishing, the fairer they were to the distant stranger of the same faith. So, again, they were playing by the rules towards people they never interact with. Participants who believed in a moralistic and punishing god were about 5 times fairer to their distant co-religionists than participants who didn't know whether their god was moralistic or not. So the conclusion is that fear seems to encourage selflessness, an act that promotes trust. Fear specifically that someone is watching you. And you better act right, or else there's going to be a punishment. Quote, this is what the researcher said. Quote, when people are more inclined to behave impartially towards others, they are more likely to share beliefs and behaviors that foster the development of larger-scale cooperative institutions, trades, markets, and alliances with strangers. So, there's another guy, Dominic Johnson, politics professor at Oxford University, found the team's findings particularly compelling. He said, the study offers the most explicit evidence yet that belief in supernatural punishment has been instrumental in boosting cooperation in human societies. All right, so, however, the lead researcher cautioned everybody and said, well, don't draw too strongly a conclusion about the kindness of the people of faith. However, he said, it's easy to talk about these results as effectively suggesting that religious people are nicer, he said, but I think that's misleading. They said the results suggest cooperation, but that doesn't necessarily translate to kindness, which is an interesting thing. He said, any sort of terrorist network, they're really highly cooperative, We don't have to like their ends at all, but it's remarkable how cooperative they are. So he also said that the findings are limited to individual behavior to their religious peers. He said people who believe in a punitive God might not be so cooperative with strangers of a different or no faith. Okay, so why do I find this interesting? I don't find this interesting necessarily because it points to a positive influence that religion may have on societies. Yeah, it does that. But I find it interesting because it may lend credence to something that I've mentioned several times on the podcast. And that is that people tend to think that Christianity is schizophrenic because in the Old Testament there is a vengeful God. I'm getting my mail, one moment. In the Old Testament, there is a vengeful God. He's the God of the Old Testament who's waiting to come down and crack people on the head. He is the God that tells the Israelites, go in and wipe everybody out. And that just doesn't seem like the God of the New Testament to some people. And so they say, well, you know, Christianity's schizophrenic. You know, what God are you actually serving? You know, I tend, because I have chosen to believe in God, I tend to come at it from a different perspective. I tend to come at it from the perspective of, if there is a God and he has designed this life, it is a spectacularly well-designed life. And therefore, he's probably a pretty smart guy. One moment, I'm backing into my garage. And if he's a pretty smart guy, maybe I should, first of all, A, give him the benefit of the doubt, and then B, take just a moment of time to imagine if there might be another explanation for the fact that it does appear that the God of the Old Testament is much more vengeful, is much more punishing, is much more just and demanding of justice than the God that we see characterized as love in the New Testament. Why would that possibly be? And I've said for some times that it could very well be because God knew what the times required of him. He knew that he was bringing the Israelites out of Egypt. They had been in Egypt for 400 years. They had learned to be subservient. They had learned to respond to their taskmasters. And God presents himself as a master to them, as one to be obeyed, because maybe that's what they needed. Maybe he told the Israelites to go into the land of Palestine and to wipe everybody out because he knew that if they didn't wipe everybody out, they would be pulled away to worship other gods. Maybe God does what he does because he needs to do it at that moment, much like a parent alters their behavior with children as children are growing up. You don't treat a one-year-old child the same way you treat a two-year-old or a four-year-old or a 10-year-old or a teenager or an adult who is your child. You don't treat them the same way. And children could very well look at their parents' behavior when they are growing up and saying, oh, you know, it's just no fair. There's no justice, you know. Oh, you're not even including me. You're just telling me what I'm supposed to do. And what this article did is it kind of gave me another little piece of that puzzle because God knows us probably better than we know ourselves. And the revelation of himself as a punitive God, as a God who was watching to see behaviors. That revelation of himself as that. He could have very well made that revelation of himself as that in order to foster the creation of human society. And I think before we jump to conclusions about how God is unfair and how God is unjust and he's this and he's that, we should just pause and think back to when we were growing up and imagine, for those of us who had good parents, imagine that maybe that just like our parents treated us differently at whatever stage of life we were in, that maybe God does exactly the same thing. And maybe there's a purpose under it all. And there were very good reasons that he presented himself one way in the Old Testament and then presented himself another way in the New Testament. And maybe it was more than just the fact that Jesus came, died for our sins, reconciled the world to himself, etc., etc., etc. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.